Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Bye, bye, bye. I am brown baby.
Welcome to the Brown Baby Podcast. I'm your host, Nikesh Shukla. This is a podcast about parenting, how we raise our kids with joy and wonder in uncertain and, let's face it, increasingly bleak times. It's inspired by my memoir, Brown Baby. And each week I invite a fellow parent of brown babies, be they writers or musicians or chefs or comedians or actors, to talk about their parenting journeys and the highs and lows have experienced along the way. I want this to be a frank and funny and poignant look at parenting, and hopefully it will spark honest and self-effacing conversations about how we tell our kids about the world. We will talk about parenting fails, plus the best and worst advice that we've ever received. I'm hoping this is going to be the comforting, uplifting podcast for anyone who's ever found themselves searching for answers in a sleep-deprived Google hole. Step away from that Google hole. Do not go to that Google hole. This week's guest is the legendary writer Courtier Newland. More on him on a second. First, look. My memoir is coming out, Brown Baby. It's about parenting and it's about grief and it's about finding joy in bleak times. Kind of like this podcast. Here's what Bernardine Evaristo had to say about the book. And you know, Bernardine Evaristo is a legend, by the way. Brown Baby is a beautifully intimate and soul-searching memoir. It speaks to the heart and the mind and bears witness to our turbulent times. Thanks, Bernie. Please do buy it. From wherever you get your books, links to where you can get it in the show notes. But if you have a preferred place, use that preferred place. I am not here to judge. I know lots of people are like sniffy about using certain sites that begin with A. And much as it's not my preferred way of buying stuff and I will always try and support, I have no right to tell you where to buy your things. Okay, on to this week's guest, Courtier Newland. This is a real special one for me. He has been there my entire writing career. And, you know, I was kind of nervous talking to him, actually, because this is probably the first time we've had a proper chat peer-to-peer. Whenever we've had chats before, it's always been where he's kind of been like someone I look up to, you know. And this time we were sitting down talking writer to writer. He felt nervous, amazingly. I idolized him when I read The Scholar in 2001, and I've read every single one of his books ever since. And in 2004 he gave me my first start alongside Nia Yeakwe Parks and Rajiv Balasubramaniam by putting me in an anthology called Telltales, which we talk about in the podcast. He's the author of so many books, but the one I want to draw your attention to is A River Called Time, which just came out in January 2021 on Canongate. It's an epic speculative sci-fi about an arc, about humanity, about social inequality. It's so big and moving and astonishing, and the world that he creates is just immense and brilliant. I can't wait for you to read it. Courtier also wrote on the Small Axe series that Steve McQueen directed, especially Lover's Rock, which takes place at a house party and is one of the most beautiful and soulful and sexiest things I've seen in years. I'm looking forward to you hearing our chat, where we talk about, you know, raising boys, what it's like raising a mixed race kid who is black and Indian, And what else do we talk about? We talk about technology and we talk about writing. You know, it's always going to come up when you're talking to other writers. And we talk about what kind of parent he is and what kind, you know, his own childhood and how that kind of informed how he parents now. Before we talk, though, my kids and I have been reading this book series that is a parody about the princess life. It's by Philippa Gregory. And my kids are obsessed with princesses, okay? You know, they love princesses. And the book is, the book series is just, you know, it's like a pastiche. It's like a spoof of the princess life. And the volume that we're reading at the moment is really funny. And it's basically about how a boy prince comes along and kind of usurps the older princess. And she gets annoyed. And today, a few days after reading about how this younger prince is going to become king and the older princess will just get married off and what the rules are for princesses compared to princes, my daughters are outraged. They're like 6 and 3. And the 3-year-old said, it's not fair that boys get to do what they want and girls don't. And the oldest one was saying, well, why isn't she going to be the queen? Because she's the oldest. It's just not fair. And then she said, if there was a boy, if the king and queen had twins, a boy twin and a girl twin, who would be the king or queen? And we were like, well, probably the boy, sadly. And she was outraged. And they just don't like it. And just because he's a boy, and that's not how they want them. That's not how they want the world to be. And it's brilliant to watch them form their rage against unfair systems in real time. I mean, we can take down the monarchy at a later date, guys. But all I can do is yes and what they're saying about feminism and their patriarchy and ensure that I never perpetuate what they're railing against. But you know what? This is exactly why I think representation matters in kids' books. Because these kids are seeing a world that they do not like and they want to do something about it. And that, for me, fills me with so much hope. Okay, now for my interview with Cordelia Newland.
All right, good.
Cool. Welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm good, man. Oh, good. Happy.
Oh, good. Yeah, it's been like, it must be such an incredible time for you at the moment. We've just had both of your small acts films have been on now, and yeah, it's less than a month till A River Called Time comes out. Well, obviously, A River Called Time was supposed to come out in August of 2020, I think, if I'm remembering it rightly, and then it got pushed to January because of COVID. I mean, that book has been a long time in the making, so how does it feel for it to so nearly be out?
Yeah, it's a massive, massive relief to get it out there, and also it's just really nerve-wracking as well, you know, because after 18 years of saying, oh, I think this is good, and trying to make it right and get it right and stuff, I'm just like forensically looking at all the little details now of it and saying, oh, you know, got to make sure it's properly correct now. So yeah, it's great. I'm so pleased. Yeah, so pleased.
And having spoken about wanting to move into writing sci-fi for so long and like finally doing this like big, epic, speculative fiction, or is it time slip? I don't know what the whatever it is. It must feel like it's like such a sense of relief, as you said. But
yes, massive relief. But also, I just didn't think it was going to be this one. I thought it was going to be something else. I thought it was going to be a novel that I've been thinking about writing for a while. I was preparing myself to jump into it, which is also sci-fi. It turned out to be this one after all. So yeah, it's just been this is the right one to start with, I feel. This is like definitely the one that sets my stall out. Nothing would be as big as this, so I just think to start with the big one and then, you know, whatever else afterwards.
You've also been teasing a short story collection called Cosmogramma for about a decade now as well. When's that one dropping?
I wasn't meant to be a tease. I really wasn't meant to. It was meant to drop every time I said it was going to drop. That's coming out next year as well. So I'm going to have two books out in the same year. Cosmogramma's coming out later in the year. So yeah, you guys get to read it at last and stuff. And the novel was going to be one of those short stories expanded a bit. So I'm really excited now that it gets aired in the proper way.
I remember seeing a talk you did once, and you talked a lot about the editing process and that being where you find the novel, and actually the editing process for you can take longer than the actual writing of the novel. What is it about the editing process, that like how do you remain so forensic when you've been looking at the same draft for as long as you have? Because I find that after a while, time off helps me, but you know, if I have to constantly relook at it, I get complacent with it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that happens to me too. I think that what the gift is time, really, is just to be able to kind of take that step back and then relook at it, take a step back and relook at it. And that was one of the major things, I think, with River, is that I had so much time away from it that when I came back to do the rest of it, like parts 2, 3, and 4, it just all just gushed out of me. It was like really, it was literally like a river, and it was just like just constant, and I couldn't stop thinking about it, and it's building and building. So, but I feel, I mean, I'm getting to the saturation point with River. I was just looking at it again this week actually, and my eyes started to literally bleed. They were burning and everything, so I'm not immune to that at all. But I think it's just I do love the editing process more than I love the writing process, and that's never changed. But
why is that?
It does tend to be.
Do you think?
I just fix everything, you know. Like I always go into it, like I write the first draft being like, okay, I know there's a ton of mistakes in here. And then editing is like, I can fix this. I can make this better. And the mantra when I'm writing the first draft is, you know, you can fix this, so don't worry.
Yeah.
Don't look back. Just get to the end, you know.
I really hope all of my creative writing students are listening to this, so they know it's not just me who says that. The first draft is just getting it from brain to page, and every draft after that is trying to edit it so it matches what's in your brain.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what the funny thing is about that is that the more you do the editing process, the better your first drafts tend to be. Yeah. So now I can do like Gospel According to Cain, literally that's it. That's how it came out. I didn't really touch it that much. We did edits and stuff, and we kind of honed everything, precision and stuff. But in terms of structure and character and all that stuff, all the scenes, it's pretty much the way it was in first draft. And you get to a point where every now and then, with a story or with a novel or something like that, that will happen. It'll just be like, okay, that's all right. I don't need to worry about that so much. And then something else, like River, you're like, no, I need to move things around and polish and whatever. Yeah. But you know how to do both of those things, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Like, obviously, this is the Brown Baby podcast, so I do want to move on to talking about kids and, you know, both of us being dads and that. But I just want to kind of go back a little bit, because I think one of the things that's sort of tripping me out about doing this podcast with you is, like, I owe a lot to, like, Telltales Volume 2, which was the first time that I'd ever been published. And I think about, you know, that it's right here. It's like pride of place on my desk. It's right there.
Oh wow, well done.
And it was like, you know, I was writing and I was trying to be a political rapper, and I was, you know, not spending enough time on either of them. And then the politics that was in the raps that sort of ended up in this short story. And it kind of, I really remember when those copies turned up, and it was the thing that got me first was seeing the barcode on the back of the book, because I immediately thought, this is legit, it's got a barcode.
Yeah.
And then seeing, you know, you've got a short story in there, Romesh Gunasekara had a short story, like Kamala Shamsi, like all these amazing people, and I just sort of felt like, I didn't feel like you were my peers, but I felt like my writing was good enough to be amongst yours, and that was a huge deal for me. And so I feel like my entire career I owe to that commission. Like I would not have had I wouldn't have had like the strength or like the, like, it's almost like a feeling of permission to kind of carry on, but so much more than that, because I think it also, the work that went into the editing and the time I spent chatting to Rajiv and Nee who were editing that volume, and also like talking briefly to you about a couple of things, I definitely realized the value of like role models in your life, like just kind of spending time with you and giving you the space to kind of be who you are and offering advice and offering support. And that's kind of gone into the rest of my career in terms of mentoring. And that's why I do as much mentoring as I do, because of you guys, because you guys were so, like, that was such a seminal experience for me. And I wonder if, like, that baton passing, if that had happened for you, and that's how you then carried it forward, and who your mentors were, and who were the people who were basically spending that time with you, sitting down with young Kortier and going, look, you can do this, you just got to work hard. And and be your own I can't remember how Nee put it. Like, you've got to be your own worst critic. Like, you've got to say all the stuff to yourself that you wouldn't want anyone else to say, and that will kind of force you to work harder.
Exactly. I mean that's exactly what happened. You know, I was mentored by a guy called Barney Platts Mills, who was a filmmaker, older than me, lived in Ladbroke Grove. He was mentoring a lot of kids at the time. Saloom NJ, who went on to become a filmmaker, you know, he's mentoring him. And he had this project called Massive Video, which was run out of a youth centre called Seven Feathers in the middle of Sutton's Estate, just at the back of North Pearl Road. And he was involved in YCTV, North Kensington Film and Drama Projects. He was involved in those two projects as well. And basically, he met my best friend, and he said to my best friend, do you know anyone who wants to make a film? And my friend was like, no, but my mate's writing a book, and he's really good, and you should meet him. And so he said, yeah, okay, I'll meet him. And I met him at St. Helens Church, their youth centre in the basement. This is just down the road from Grenfell, actually. And I met him there and gave him my, you know, three chapters of the Scholar, basically. And he took them and said, okay, I'll get back to you. And I was like, yeah, you know, if you take that and you do anything with it, I'll see you. And he kind of looked me up and down. He's like, yeah, all right, whatever. And then about a week later, he turned up at my house. And he had a big computer monitor, and he had a keyboard, and he had a hard drive, and they all had Ilya stamped all over them. and he gave them to me, and he said, you said you don't have a computer, so now you've got no excuses, just get on and write. And my mum was like behind me going, what does he want? And I was like, I don't know, mum. And then I just, took it upstairs. I was just baffled. He didn't even tell me he was coming. He just turned up at my door with this stuff, and I started writing, and he took me through every step of the process. Basically, I would tape my pages to him, and he would go through them with a big red marker, and he would just be like, you know, this is when, like, during the writing process and afterwards, just like, no, and if you move this word here, that makes a cleaner sentence, and do you see what I'm doing here, do you see how I'm cutting that out and whatever. We did that every day for about a year or so, just working on the Scholar. And then after that was done, we did the edits, and then after that was done, he started trying to put me in contact with agents, and that's how I got signed by William Morris, was through Barney as well. And he never asked me for anything at all. I tried to pay him afterwards when I got my first advance. He was like, what are you doing? That just put that away. It's crazy.
But that to me just tells me everything about the type of community that should exist amongst writers. And it does, I think. I guess one of the things that I've been doing a lot in the last 5 years is, like, you know, talking about representation and publishing and all that kind of stuff, and wearing that on my shoulders, and like trying to do stuff, like, for all the mistakes I made along the way and whatever, like, I was still felt like, you know, that thing that had been fostered for me so clearly before, like, the only way to pay that back was to pay it forward. And I guess that's all you can do, and I guess that's what makes, like, really important, like, role models in our lives, and people that we kind of look up to, as people who foster a community where you're not doing anything for the sake of your own ends. You're doing it to keep the community going.
I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with doing things for your own ends, as long as you think about other people too. I mean, we all have to eat. We've all got, you know, some of us have got kids to feed. You've got aspirations for yourself. I don't think there's anything wrong with having aspirations for yourself. And I don't think there's anything wrong with those aspirations involving money and success. I mean, I'd like a big house and a swimming pool at some point in time in my life. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But as long as you, in tandem with that, you are also, you know, working with the community, you are giving back, you don't forget where you came from. I think that's very important. And, you know, I just I feel like I was on the back end of a movement that had been happening in Ladbroke Grove and West London, and Shepherd's Bush and all that, West London areas, that have been going on since way back, of poor people and middle class people coming together to make things better in the community. And I was just lucky to be on the end, you know, in the 80s and stuff of that. and be a recipient of that. And I was very much like, all right, so you're not going to take this money, yeah, but I got to do something with this, because I was literally, you know, I was wandering around the street like dirt poor, you know what I mean? And like, you know, not to say my mum looked after me and stuff, but she was training to become a teacher. She just passed her teacher training, you know what I mean? She's like bringing up two boys by herself. She's doing the best she could. But at the same time, I wasn't ever in contact with the industry that I'm in contact with now in any way. And he opened the door and he showed me that that was possible. And he never once said to me, you can't. Never once, you know. So I was like, okay, that's what I can do. That's what I can give to people.
How did it feel? How did it feel to archive those times in West London in Small Axe for you?
Yeah, just beautiful, beautiful, man. I mean, it meant so much to me, and everyone could see. I think I was one of the only writers in the room who came from West London in that way, so everyone could see how much it meant to me, you know. Like, and I've spoken with some of the other writers and they've mentioned that it was such a huge deal for me, not even in the weight of responsibility or burden of representation way, just the like, oh my god, this is good. I know how people are going to feel about this, you know. And little things like in Lovers Rock, you know, the guy with the white cross, that's what we're able to do, you know. We're able to do things like that because it's us, you know. And that came from Steve, you know. Steve said to me, there was this guy in West London, he used to carry a white cross. I'm like, I know that guy, I know who you're talking about. So the fact that we could have a conversation like that and then people are seeing it, say, oh my god, it's the guy with the white cross, and that's such so West London. It was just like amazing.
Yeah. And I love in Mangrove, you can see Grenfell being built in the background.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess I use the word archive just as a way of kind of talking about not feeling like you have to represent, but just, you know, if those stories aren't told, they get forgotten. And so just being able to record the specificity of a moment, you know, we all watched Lovers Rock and all projected that version of that house party onto our, you know, into it, and it was the specificity of how it unfolds that I think really resonated with people.
Yeah, but not so much the specifics of the details itself. Like, it wasn't meant to be representative of everybody's house party, but you've all been to a party like that where the mood and the feeling was that. It was the soul of the party that we were trying to get across, not the specific details, you know. And I think that's really important, and that's all you can do with fiction, really, right? You can try and get to the emotion or heart of the thing, you know. And then you put in as many details as possible, you know, but you also, you know, you can't be trying to speak to everybody's experience, you know.
Yeah, no, definitely. And you know, what I really loved about it was this idea of that house party becoming a citadel for so many people, because and you know, in the way that I think watching it in lockdown so far away from my own family, it made me yearn for the citadel of our own house parties. And obviously these films came on around, you know, Diwali, and you know, I'm sitting there watching them and, you know, yearning for something that just in that moment felt so far away, but you know, just filled me with so much nostalgia for a really beautiful thing.
I think all of the films are about that. Just quickly, all of the films are about that connection. I mean, Lovers Rock is really focused, and it's really not obvious, but it's concentrated in that sense, you know, because it's in this house party. But you know, Mangrove is about the community coming together. Leroy Logan, I feel like he cares so much about the community, you know what I mean, that he's willing to, you know, risk everything and take the slings and arrows and stuff, and then returns back to the community represented by his father at the end, you know. Alex Wheatle finds who he is from the community, you know, when not in the home, you know what I mean, he goes into the community, and that's what saves him, is being back in Brixton, you know. Everyone embraces him and looks after him and says, hey, listen, I got you, I understand your pain, you know, like, or I can't understand your pain, but I'm gonna commiserate with you, you know. You know, education is the same. The community comes together to raise this boy up, you know. It's all about community.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a dad are you? tone is everything with that. What kind of dad are you?
Yeah.
No, it's more of a curious question. Because you know, over the years, people have spoken so warmly about what you are as a teacher and as a mentor and all the rest of it. I'm just wondering, like, how that then translates into the home space when. Your goofy dad as well.
Yeah, you'd have to ask my son that, and you'd have to ask my daughter that. They'll probably tell you their own version. I mean, I think I'm a firm dad. I think I am a firm dad. I try not to go over the top. I was talking to someone else about this. You know, straddling the line between being really, really firm and believing in discipline and stuff, and especially with my son because he's the oldest, and not going too far, and also being there for him and her, and just being able to hug them and cuddle them and say, listen, you know, like, I love you no matter what, you know. I think that's really, really important, and I'm still negotiating that. So I think I'm firm. I like to think I'm caring. I like to think I'm willing to listen to them. If there's one thing that I think I'm not doing so well, I think is being able to spend the amount of time with them that I think is necessary, both together and alone. I'm trying to do that more, but it's difficult right now. I do want to be parents, especially Caribbean parents. I'm your father, not your friend, you know. I do want to be a friend to my kids, you know. I do want them to be able to talk to me. I don't know if that makes sense to you or resonates to you.
Yeah, no, it really does, because I guess, when I was growing up, my dad was very much the silent authoritarian in the corner. I knew I was in trouble when he had to get involved. And, you know, in that way that, you know, sometimes as parents, you try and go the opposite way to your parent, like where you feel like you didn't like how you were parented, you try and do the exact opposite, which doesn't always work. And so from years of being a youth worker, where, you know, the rule is start strict and relax as you go, because you can't put your foot up on the chair and like lean on it and say, hey, I'm just like you guys with young people, because that's the point at which you've lost all your authority in the room. But you can start strict and go, I am your youth worker. And then as you go, but, you know, bond with them. But with my kids, I feel like I'm too much the other way. I'm too much like, I want to be their friend. I want to laugh with them and make them laugh and tell them jokes. And then when I have to initiate discipline protocols, that's the moment when they're like, hold on a minute, we were laughing a second ago. Yeah. I don't get this at all.
What's going on? Yeah, I get a little bit of that, I think. But I think, you know, there's got to be, you've got to have boundaries, right? I think kids have got to have boundaries. Without boundaries, you know, then I think they yearn for boundaries as well. And I remember I was doing a residency at UWE in Trinidad, and I was away for a month. And it was all right for the first couple of weeks or so. And then in the last couple of weeks, my son was calling me, we were Skyping, and he said to me, listen, that's enough now. you got to come back. Come back now. And he said, I even miss you telling me off. I just want you to be here to tell me off. I was like, wow, that's like... So I felt like, all right, I am doing something right. You know what I mean? Because it's not so bad that he'd be like, oh, I'm so glad he's not telling me off, you know? So I think they want to be disciplined in a way, but then you have to be able to give them the other side of it afterwards, which is, okay, that's done now. Now we can sit down and watch Mandalorian together, and I can put my arm around you. And I have to give them, like, I don't want to ever feel like I can't show my son affection in that way. You know what I mean? I can't hug him or, you know, put my arm around him or hold hands with him. Or sometimes he wants to hold my hand. You know, it's cool. I'm not going to be like, oh, I can't walk down the road holding hands with you because people are around or whatever. You know, none of that.
How old is your son at the moment?
He's 12.
So he's sort of heading into teenage years and...
Very much so. Has been since he was about 8.
do you think often about what it is to raise a boy in this time, and especially a boy who's about to become a teenager and, you know, take up space in a way that they don't always understand or are aware of, but you know, and at the same time ensure that they're kind of I'm not articulating myself very well. I've got 2 daughters, so it's just something I think about a lot. How can I as a man, as a father, ensure that I'm raising my 2 daughters to kind of be boundless, but at the same time aware of how the world is?
Yeah, it's difficult. It's really difficult because, yeah, I worry about it all the time, to be honest with you. You know what I mean? Because, like, on top of everything else, I grew up in the world that I grew up in. So it's not just like being a man and being a boy, but I think I grew up in quite a stark environment. And again, not because of what was going on inside my home, but what was going on outside my home. And it was tough. It was very, very tough. When I look back on how tough it was, I'm just like, whoa, you know. And I look at my boy now and I say, he's 12 now. And when I was 12, this is what was going on, you know. I'm not even just saying just me individually, just in the world in general and what my mates were going through and stuff. Like, I had a kind of like balanced kind of upbringing in that sense. It wasn't so bad. And then there's other people who are having it really, really hard, you know. And just to know that exists out there in the world was crazy. And also, I grew up really, really super fast because it was the 80s and kids were just raised different. You know, like, we were privy to a lot of stuff that the kids now are not privy to. And we were out there and out and about. And I'd go riding about on my bike on a Sunday for hours. I'd just be seeing stuff that's going on roads, you know what I mean? So I'm very, very aware of what's out there. In some ways, that makes it worse.
That's a really interesting distinction that you made. I just wonder if we can go back to that, where in the 80s, I grew up in like late 90s and 80s as well, a little bit, but you know, we were in the world, whereas now kids have access to the world through the internet and stuff. But that doesn't necessarily put them in the world. It just kind of gives them a veneer of what the world could be like. And I think that's really interesting to be able to actually see stuff for yourself out happening in real time, and what that can do for you versus like stumbling upon a YouTube video that you shouldn't be watching because it kind of autoplays after your baby shark or whatever it is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for sure. But like in the same ways, you know, people are talking about this, oh, don't let your kids have access to the internet, and you know, because of what they might see. And I agree wholeheartedly, but no one was saying don't let your kids go out and play because of what they might see. And that's what was happening. It was, in some ways, it was worse than seeing it on a screen, because like I was actually seeing it happen. I mean, you know, a lot of violence, a lot of just stuff going on. You're like, and sometimes it would be happening to you, so or around you, or about to happen to you. You know, having to get away from people who are trying to do things to you and stuff. You know, so. You know, all the stuff that I always say to people like, used to be like, when I wrote The Scholar, they were like, oh, you know, I'd tell them about stuff that happened to me in my childhood and they'd look shocked. And then they'd say, I said, but I wrote The Scholar. And they'd say, no, I thought you were making that up. And I was like, no, I wasn't making that up. So, yeah. And so just bringing it back to, you know, my boy. Yeah, I like I said, I worry about the fact that world is out there, And there's a thing about being a boy of colour as well, particularly being a black boy, where you're really, really cute when you're a kid. And then when you hit that 13 thing, it all changes. And the world, even though you're still a kid, treats you like a man. And with all the fear and the kind of presumptions that come with that for a black man. And that's scary to me. And on all sides, not just from, you know, not for just from people who are not from your race and culture, but also people within your race and culture too.
And I guess one of the things that crops up a lot in the book that I've written about parenting and about kind of preparing our kids for the bleakness of the world is, I guess, for me, there's always a tension between projecting my cynicism and my jadedness based on stuff that I've experienced onto them versus what it's actually going to be like for them versus ensuring that they just see the world through their own right. They project their own vision of the world onto it. And that's something that I struggle with daily. I guess that's part of why I'm doing this podcast, because I get to talk to amazing people and kind of get their insight into this, because like, this is the thing they never tell you about parenting is like, we're all kind of just feeling our way through this.
Yeah, totally. I mean, just to you know, it's a really good point that you raised. And just to kind of contextualise where I'm at with that, I was brought up in West London until I was about three. I was born in West London, brought up in West London until I was about three. Then my mum and dad moved, and they moved to Uxbridge, where I was one of two or three black families in the area. The only black kid in my school was a guy that was so much older than me. I won't say his name, but yeah, he's so much older than me. And so I was literally the only black kid in my school, the only black kid in my area. There was this other family that we were good friends with, but they were kind of outside of Uxbridge and they moved in later, and I'd already moved out by then. My mum and dad split up, and my mum moved out of Uxbridge when I was about seven or eight. And we moved back to Shepherd's Bush, back to White City. You can never say those two things like they're the same place to anyone in West London, so sorry about that. But yeah, I moved back to, you know, like being living by the A40 Westway at that point in time. And I lived there, you know, in West London up until very, you know, I was like late 20s or something. So I grew up in a very, very hostile, majority white environment where women would try and fight my mum outside the school gates. They tried to make me draw my mum pink when I was in nursery school, you know, and then when I refused to, they shouted at me and, you know, all this stuff. And regular racism from my friends in the school, all sorts of stuff. It was just really intense. And I grew up a lot of the time as a kid just being really upset and depressed, and I didn't know I was upset and depressed and wanting to be white. I make no bones about that was the experience. I didn't know I was doing that, but I would, you know, put my sweatshirt on top of my head and pretend I had long hair and stuff like that, you know. So luckily my mum moved me out and moved me back. She's really worried about my mental state at that time, so she moved me back to an environment where there were lots of black people. And it's funny because that story is like Derek Owusu's story is very similar to that. Alex Wheaton's story is very similar to that. And I think that, what's going on with that? How come all three of us ended up in this space now talking about stuff, you know? How we became writers. Interesting. My wife had a similar upbringing in East London, in majority white environment, lots and lots of racism. So we kind of had a discussion about this in terms of raising our kids. And we said that we don't want them to have to think about race and racism as kids. We want them just to be kids. You know what I mean? Not have, because I've had to think about it a lot. And it's one of those things that made me older than I should have been. You know, like seeing someone come to fight your mum and calling her all sorts of like racial expletives, you know. It's like, you're going to get older from that, you know, like no matter what happens. So, yeah, with our kids, we try to just like let them be kids, actually. That's the primary thing. And also stimulate their sense of cultural well-being and belonging. That's kind of our plan.
And that's really wonderful, because that kind of prepares them early on for being proud of who they are and where they've come from. Because, you know, they're black and they're also South Asian, mixed race. And one of the things that is really interesting about raising mixed race kids from what I've seen is like when you're in the majority default or what is currently the default environment, it becomes so much harder to kind of raise your kids with that sense of heritage and culture, so, especially when you know half the family in my case is white, so you know that's their default for them, so it kind of has to become my thing. And my worry was always that, you know, that those bits would just be the stuff that they do with dad and his family, rather than it's something that we all engage in. And, you know, my wife's been really good at ensuring that she gets her involved in all the cultural stuff. And how has that been for you guys, balancing that?
I mean, it's a state of experimentation all the time, you know, but what we said very early on was that we both have to get involved with everything. So we can't say that this is what dad does and this is what mum does. I mean, they ask some interesting questions, man. My daughter asked me the other day, like, why mummy didn't marry someone Indian. And I was just like, wow, that's a big question for a 5-year-old. It's like, okay, let me see if I can tackle this now, you know. And so, you know, but what we've done, I suppose, is that, you know, we kind of make sure both cultures are given equal prominence in the home, in the things we talk about. You know, she'll see, you know, my wife's side of the family come here and engage with us in the things that we do. And then we go over and we engage in things that they do. And it's like, so we try and make it as seamless as possible. We also make sure they have a connection to Africa. Make sure they have a connection, because you know, my wife's family is from Africa as well. So as well as it being my heritage, of course. So you know, Africa, we engage in a lot. We go back to the Caribbean. We go to India as well. You know, we try and make it just normalize. This is who you are. You are not half of anything. You are whole of both things. You know what I mean? So this makes up who you are.
Yeah, I really love that. It is so important, because I think ultimately, you know, as kids become teenagers and teenagers become adults, they will forge their own identities for themselves. My worry is always ensuring that they don't have an absence of something with which to then try and forge their identity as they become adults around that absence, you know.
Yeah, it's the absence that is the issue, I think, and that what I see is causing an issue in people. When people tend to have less problems, from what I've seen, is when they feel connected, they feel that connection. So even little things like being able to know what to eat and know what things are, you know, I want them to feel comfortable. I was like, it's a bit of a joke in our family, but it's not a joke in the sense. I want them to be able to go into the Caribbean takeaway and know what to order. You know what I mean? I don't want them to be asking anyone, what's that, what's that, what's that? And now it's making light of the thing, but it goes for everything. I want them to be very, very comfortable with all sides of their heritage. But also, you know what, my son's learning about Islam right now. I want him to know about that too, you know what I mean? There's no one that I know of in my family. I'm sure there are people in my family who are Muslim, but it's part of the world, man. It's part of what's going on. It's part of the world that you live in, and you should know as much about that as possible. I'm really glad the school is doing that, and I'm trying to tell him as much about that as possible. And there's a Quran here for when he's ready. You know what I mean? So I want him to have a knowledge of world cultures, because that will make you a richer person too.
I wonder if part of that is because you are, because to be, I think to be a good writer is to be curious about the world. You know, to be a writer is to kind of go, well, I don't know how airplane engines work. I might just read that Wikipedia page. I might understand like 20% of it, but it might spin something out, you know, in the same way that like knowing what different, you know, what different religions are, knowing what the different cultures are, like, you know, that curiosity feeds me so much. And I think one of the best things to be as a child is to be curious. And I don't necessarily feel like my parents gave me the space to be curious. So I kind of had to look out for stuff, like find stuff out by myself. And that's kind of where a library came into my life at the right time.
Right.
But were you quite a curious child?
Oh, completely. And I tried, because I was told, I saw people talking about how people lost their curiosity becoming an adult. So I always tried to hold on to it. And I think, we can't be a great writer, I think, or even a good writer, halfway decent writer, without being curious, you know. So I try and encourage that. Funnily enough, I'm talking about my boy a lot, just because he's engaging with the world in a different way from my daughter, who's five. So I'm sorry if it feels like I'm like dumb, you know. He's dominating the conversation, but I'm finding it interesting where he's going in terms of his learning. Well,
he's forging something now, whereas your daughter...
He's forging something right now. My daughter is an open sponge. She's curious about everything. It's just like, it just comes flooding in and she's trying things out and she's at that stage. My son started off that way, but I think, and this is, I'm not blaming the education system, but in a sense, just that whole thing of like going to school and being able to do enough to pass a test or answer questions or being in a room where someone else will answer the question has dulled that a little curiosity a little bit. So when we were talking about Islam, like yesterday or something like that, I said to him, we just bought him a robot. We bought him a Cosmo robot for his birthday. The family did. We all pulled together to buy him this one present because it's very expensive. And I was talking to him about a guy called Al Jazari, who was the father of robotics when he came out of Islam. You know what I mean? He's making like clockwork robots and stuff that served water and could do all these amazing things way before robotics was invented in Europe. And my son was like, I don't need to know about that kind of stuff. You know, it's kind of like, what? How can you be saying that? You know, and it's because he said it's nothing to do with what they're teaching. That's something else. That's something different. I was like, encouraging. I had to re-encourage him again about the beauty of curiosity. You know what I mean? And I'm telling you this story because it's about the world and you need to know what's going on in the world. And that's, you might be able to use that one day because you're into robots. How can you not want to know that, you know? So
it's almost like being interested in stuff gets shamed out of you as you become a teenager.
Yeah, exactly. And
like, I can remember that. I can remember feeling like suddenly I wanted to replace all those encyclopedias with like football paraphernalia. But like what I actually wanted to be reading was comics, you know. But, you know, this was the 80s and 90s and comics weren't, you know, superheroes were not did not have the cultural impact that they do now. But, you know, that idea of like ensuring that kids remain interested, or, you know, teenagers remain interested in the world is so important. I think that's why, like, you know, whenever my kid, you know, my kid's six now, whenever she expresses even a minor interest in something, we're like, right, let's get out the books, let's look it up, let's just keep that going, because she's just started school and I want to, and while she still really enjoys going to school, I want to retain that joy of learning, because it's, you know, it's there for me and for my wife a lot, but, you know, I don't want it to go from her.
Yeah, and it's not, like I said, it's not the school's fault. It's just this idea of this is the way that you learn becomes the prescriptive way that you learn. Yeah. You know, you just read books and you recite things back and then you've learnt it, you know. And the idea that learning is never ending is what I want to put into his head. And we're just about getting to the point where that's necessary now, because he's now settled into that form of learning. He's like, okay, this is the way that I can get by. You know, he's very good at school. You know, he does really well. And even though we've been homeschooling since the whole lockdown and stuff, you know, he continues to do well. And he does have a sense of curiosity. You know, he's very curious about a lot of things. But I remember that too. I remember where if something didn't hold my interest, that's it. I don't want to know. And and I think that was detrimental to my growth. And you have to actively encourage them that all learning is good and necessary and will help you some way down the line. You know,
I think we've talked a little bit about this, but I'd really love to kind of give it its own spotlight. What is your big tip for raising kids to be filled with joy and boundlessness when everything outside our front doors seems so bleak?
God, free tips. I think you've got to retain a sense of optimism. You know, there's that Dave Chappelle sketch where it's like he's talking about Donald Trump. He's saying, imagine if you, yeah, talk to your kids the way Donald Trump talks to the world and says, you know, oh, well, actually, it's really, really terrible outside. You know, it's really bad. Things are terrible. You know, of course, you don't do that. So to retain that sense of optimism when you're talking to them, you know, I think, like, allow them their childhood, you know. And this is not to say you kind of bury your head in the sand and you don't talk about things. You talk about things in a really constructive way. My mum had a saying, this is the second thing, by the way. My mum had a saying when I was growing up, which was, if you ask about it, you're ready to know. And so she never, ever, whatever I asked her about, whether it was to do with sex or anything, if I asked about, you might get an abbreviated version. You might not get everything, but she would never say, you're too young to know about that. You might be too young to do that, you know what I mean? But you're not too young to know about that, so we'll have that conversation. I carry that forward into my parenting as well. I thought that's really cool that my mum did that for me. And I suppose, and the third thing is, don't be afraid to be their parent. I think I see a lot of people who are afraid to give them the discipline, to be like, because, oh, my kid might hate me. And you know, I just don't think that's true. As long as you're like, you know, you've got both sides of the coin, you show them that love afterwards, you give it some time, but show them that love afterwards, they will understand why you did the other stuff. They will get to a point where they look back and you say, oh, I get it. I get it with my mom. I get it with my dad. I understand. And I'm grateful to them for the discipline that they showed me. So, yeah.
Corche Newland, cool. Thank you so much.
Thank you, bro. Nice one.
Thank you so much to Corche Newland for joining me on the Brown Baby podcast. What a great guest. What a great chat. And just a reminder that his book, A River Called Time, is out now on Canongate. And it's incredible. Also, Brown Baby, my memoir, is out as well. Please pick them both up. Pick them both up. Buy them. Please, please, please. This was free. Join me next week for another installment of the Brown Baby podcast. Another great interview coming up. Subscribe, leave comments, tell your friends to subscribe. Big us up on social media if you want. And also have a great week. And see you next week. Thank you to my publishers, Bluebird, and to Acast for supporting this podcast. And to Courtier, and to you. All of you. Unless you're my enemy and you hate listening to this. If that's you, and you're my enemy and you are hate listening to this, I've just got one question for you. Who has the time, bro? There's so much good stuff on the internet. Allow me. What about the rest of all the stuff? Why are you wasting your time with me? We only have limited time on this earth. But you know what? The rest of you, I love you very dearly. Goodbye, everyone. Bye-bye.
Brown baby, I am brown baby. Yes, I am.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.